Session number 11105, Colonel M. McBain, Reel 9.
Colonel M. McBain, Reel 9. What date did you arrive in Korea, Colonel?
I haven't the faintest idea. I think it must have been late autumn. Sorry, not late autumn, late August, early autumn. We were still wearing summer clothing. And we were in shirt sleeves and so on. So it must have been, I think, late summer or very early autumn. We arrived at Pusan, which, I mean, from a ship is the same as any other port, and it was there that we were issued with our equipment, our personal webbing equipment, from memory, and it was 1944 pattern. That was the green webbing that was produced during the war for jungle operations in the Far East, and in fact was very good. I'm saying that because one memory of Pusan Harbour is seeing a whole load of cardboard boxes having been thrown off the ship that had had water bottles in them, the water bottle from this equipment, and these cartons had been thrown overboard and they still had the water bottles in them, and so the harbour appeared to be full of 44 pattern water bottles for some reason. I don't know.
Was there any reception for you when you landed?
Yes, there were, but again, as a junior officer, the platoon commander, you tended to be busy doing things like getting soldiers out into where they should be, and making sure the decks were clean and chores and so on. I'm sure there was a reception party of some sort, but I wasn't personally aware of it. I do remember there was a large American Army band on the quayside playing, which was particularly impressive because it had two very, very large Negroes playing the sousaphone. And there was a famous picture of one of these men with, I don't suppose he was the smallest man in the battalion, but he was a fairly small Geordie standing beside him looking up at this enormous great black man with his sousaphone. And again, from memory, we went straight off onto a train. I think we marched to the train. And we got on this train, which appeared fairly all right from the outside. In fact, it was a wooden bench seats. And so on, the rolling stock carriages. It was American run, American Army, US Army run, in every way driven and controlled by them. There was a cooking wagon in the middle of the train where compo rations, tin rations were cooked and so on, as we discovered later. And off we went.
This wasn't the French type train with the men into a kind of a cattle truck situation, was it?
No. These were ordinary third class wagons, passenger wagons. And all the officers were travelling together. We weren't travelling with our soldiers particularly. I mean, the thing was wide open. And it was summer, I think, because it was quite hot and all the windows were open of the train, I remember. It wasn't going very fast. And off we went, northwards.
What was your first impressions of Korea?
As I say, Pusan was the same as any other port, really. You know, it had grotty bits, and it had obviously been knocked around during the war because the Chinese, I think, whether it was the Chinese or the North Koreans, got very close to Pusan at one time. It was all a bit grey and scruffy and so on. And then out into the countryside, I think we were all pleasantly surprised at how attractive the countryside was. It was hilly, a lot of green vegetation, not tropical vegetation, but nice green hillsides and trees. Little villages of mud houses with thatched roofs, which all from the train all look neat and tidy. And a surprising thing, in the bigger towns, fairly substantial brick or stone, normally brick from memory, very English-looking churches, because apparently the Church of England missionaries had done well in Korea. And it was a bit surprising seeing these fairly substantial, very English-looking churches with steeples and everything in these little towns.
Were you aware of where you were going and what you were going to do?
Oh, we knew, yes, I mean, we knew the programme. When we got to the railhead, which I will say, but I'm probably wrong, is a place called Wijongbu. But that was the railhead, and we all got off there. And we went straight away into bivouac camp, where very fleetingly we saw the KSLI, who we weren't actually taking over from them. They were a battalion leaving as we were coming in. And in fact, we took some of their soldiers who still had time to do. As I say, it wasn't a relief, as we did meet them. And then I can't remember how long we were in that. The weather was fine, so it's no great discomfort. We then moved into the reserve line, bearing in mind that by this time, 1952, the war had come to a standstill, and it was very much sort of 1914-18 type stuff. And so you had the front line, and behind that, some distance behind from memory, 5-10 miles behind, was the reserve line. And we went into a battalion position on there, with two aims, really. One was to acclimatise ourselves and get used to the terrain and conditions and so on. But also, of course, to dig out this battalion position and put it back into some semblance of order, because it was a bit collapsed.
What kind of organisation was this position? How was it?
It was a series of hill features, generally speaking, each with a company on it, with a trench system near the top. They weren't very high hills, 500 feet, 1,000 feet. They varied a bit. There were some steep, more mountainous features, but this particular position, and it was in fact just behind the Gloucester's Imjin position. And in fact, the forward companies were in the Gloucester's position, overlooking the Imjin. And so we spent, as a company, I was in B Company, and as a company, we spent, let's say, a week, can't remember how long, digging that lot out. And that was quite interesting, because nobody had been near it, I don't think, since the Gloucesters had left. other than the Chinese, obviously, but, you know, and there was a lot of ammunition lying around and a lot of slightly strange things, like bits of pyjamas and greatcoats and things, okay.
Were these British?
Oh, yeah, this was British kit.
What did the position comprise of, exactly? When you say company position, what kind of...
Well, as I say, it... let's say you had a hill feature, you would have the three rifle platoons on there. Each platoon would have its area with its tasks to defend that particular sector of the hill, and that would be a series of two or three man weapon pits with a small bunker, shelter bunker, at either end of the slit trench. And then each slit trench was connected by a communication trench, which could be 6-7 feet deep. And so the whole company position was linked together, and you could move from one slit trench right the way around in the communication trench. Company headquarters was normally in a fairly substantial bunker, as were the platoon headquarters in a bunker. These bunkers were, I'll say, homemade. That sounds a bit strange, but I mean, we made them out of local materials, whatever they were. Because there weren't many big trees around, and so it wasn't a question of chopping big trees down and making the roof beams and that sort of thing. We tended to use perhaps 6-foot pickets, wiring pickets for the roofing. There was lots of corrugated iron, crinkly tin, as the soldiers called it. Sandbags, of course, millions of sandbags. And this was really the start of the battalion reputation, which it gained during its year in Korea, of being a very good position preparer. Every place we went to, we seemed to have to spend the first week or so getting it up to scratch by our standards. And, of course, in those days, there was still a very high proportion of miners or ex-miners in the battalion who were used to clouting around with picks and shovels.
The communication trench that you mentioned, was that on a basic First World War pattern of the zigzagging and traversing?
No, it was just following the feature of the hill, really. It really was a communication trench to get from A to B. There was no question of... Nobody actually lived in there. Although the accommodation bunkers, which could be anything from 2 up to 4 men, they were always, whenever possible anyway, on the reserve slope, on the reverse slope, away from the enemy.
So the men
for obvious reasons.
The men would sleep in their bunkers
on the reverse slope.
And would be doing their duty, rota, or what it is.
Normally, depended where you were. If you were in the forward position, the forward company, you would be on the night shift. You'd be up on, well, in fact, really, I suppose the whole battalion was, but particularly in the forward companies, you were on the night shift. You were up all night digging, repairing, standing patrols, and generally on the qui vive for whatever might happen. And then you slept by day with the minimum number of sentries on the forward slope, keeping an eye open. The reserve companies, they tended to find the patrols. I mean, at this stage, inevitably, as far as platoons were concerned, the main activity was patrolling, except from some forward positions where you were stuck. And so the patrols were normally found by the reserve companies. And they would tend to be up during the day and then patrolling and or whatever, you know. But they tended to be up during the day and sleeping at night. We were up during the night, sleeping by day.
So in this reserve position, which is in effect your experience, your first experience of going at the line, were they wired in as well?
Oh yes, I mean we there was a lot of we did a lot of wiring, and that was one of the more amusing episodes. One of my fellow platoon commanders had just before we left England just done his platoon commander's course, and they'd been shown how to put up a double apron wire fence, and off we went. And he got his platoon to make his wire fences all tight and taut and neat and so on. Mine and the other platoons tended to be a bit floppy and saggy and so on, and so he would come round and say, you know, that's not really very good, a bit scruffy, all this wire flopping around the place. Which we agreed, but I mean, that, but then the company commander, who was a very, very experienced officer from the Second World War, came round and told our colleague that he'd got it all wrong because his wire was so tight and taut, all he had to do was climb up it like a ladder and over it, whereas ours was all floppy, and you, if you tried that, you got all tangled up in it, which was the whole point. No, there was a lot of wire. There were a lot of minefields, quite a lot unmarked. Nobody really knew whose they were.
Were you getting any kind of opportunity for the experience of other people who were there to, again, to give you some notion of what you were facing?
Not from memory, no. I can't remember meeting anyone. I'm sure there must have been briefing sessions. I honestly can't even remember. In fact, I know. I don't think we did a recce of the first position we went on to, you know, when we actually went into operations. We must have done, but it doesn't register. And I suppose we spend a month digging out and repairing this position. And it was good experience, and it was just as if we were in the line without the external factors.
What were the conditions for living, eating, sleeping?
Well, we were in bunkers, and it was up to you. I mean, obviously the first thing about a bunker was hopefully it would protect you when things were dropping around you. The incentive, of course, in the reserve line wasn't quite so strong, and so possibly, in fact, I know really the main concern in the reserve line was to make it weatherproof. Whether it would stop any enemy activity was of secondary interest at that stage, because we were way back from any artillery or mortar fire. So it was weatherproofing, because it was beginning. The Korean summer is wet, and you know it did rain, and things then got cloudy. I mean, just like the First World War in France must have been, trenches running with water and drips coming through the bunker roof and so on, sandbags falling apart and trenches falling in, generally clouting about. We were living on fresh rations, which were very good. The rationing system was basically Australia and New Zealand, and we fed very well on fresh rations, cooking ourselves. We had a platoon cook, extremely good food.
So food was given out to platoon level?
Food was brought up to platoons by the colour sergeant in a truck. We certainly eventually, but I think we did at this stage, we had, each platoon or company had a group of Korean, South Korean porters who would carry the heavy stuff around. These A-frames, which were really like a nearest comparison is a blackboard easel, which they would strap incredible loads onto. You know, they'd put 400 or 500 weight on there, and they would have a strap around their foreheads, back to the A-frame, and off they'd go up the hill with this load, because obviously everything had to be taken up to the top of the hill, water, food, ammunition, radio batteries, everything. And these guys used to take it up, carry it up. The clothing we had was perfectly all right. It was towards the end of this training session that we started to get the bits and pieces of our winter clothing. And so that's what makes me think it must have been late autumn. Sorry, late summer, early autumn, when we were actually in the reserve line. And then, just before we were going into the line, we got our winter clothing.
And what did that comprise of?
Oh, boy. It was very, very good. It was the best in Korea. It was very much sought after by everybody else. From the top, I mean, there was a cap with ear flaps, but we tended to stick to berries. We kept our berries. And then you started off with string vest and long johns, and then a shirt, an ordinary army woolen shirt on the top of that, and then a pullover on top of that, and then a combat jacket. I mean, it's certainly what it's called now. I'm trying to think whether it was actually called a combat jacket in 1952. Let's call it a combat jacket. It was a plain green gabardine material with a zip up the front and pockets. And then over the top of that, a parka, which is a great big sort of synthetic fur-lined thing with a tail hanging down the back, which used to come up between your legs and button in the front, and a hood with a wire, proper Nanook of the Arctic stuff. And then on your feet, ordinary socks, and then the thick socks, and then these boots, EWW, cold, wet weather. They had insoles, plastic insoles. And they had cloth laces compared to the British Army at that stage, and its ordinary boots were still in leather laces. And on your hands, some very skinny gloves, and then ordinary woolen mitts, and then big, heavy, sort of leathery leather mitts over the top of that. So it was, and it was good Arctic kit. Obviously, depending on what you were doing and what the weather was, whether you wore it all or not.
Was this British manufacture?
Yeah, it was. It was all British. It was all the same. It was uniform coloured, olive green. And part of the kit was a sleeping bag with a liner. By today's standards, by 1991 standards, pretty basic sleeping bag. But I mean, they were magic to us, because up till then we'd been on bundles of blankets. And the sleeping bag came in a little bag itself, which you carried it in. And that was it, really.
Hygiene and latrines, how were they?
They were just deep holes. And the urinals were desert roses. They were ammunition tubes, either cases or the containers from tank rounds, sunk into the ground. Obviously, hygiene was important. We paid a lot of attention to it, with the result that There were very, very few cases of medical sickness. But you had a platoon of medical orderlies, hygiene guy, who used to go around with his disinfectant and so on. That, of course, I suppose, thinking about it again, is one of the memories of the place, is the smell of Jay's fluid or whatever it was, and so on, you know. Better that than a lot of other smells.
You were able to move around in daylight quite freely, were you, in this position?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because there was no enemy air activity, and we were, I don't know how far back we were, it must have been 6 or 7 miles at least, back from the front line. Oh, we could hear the front line, and we could hear the guns, because the guns were between us, obviously, in the front line. But only as a background, nothing very dramatic.
You said that the health was no problem. It was pretty good. As a platoon officer, again, still dwelling in this reserve position, of course, getting used to what was to come, what were the duties of a platoon officer, say, for a day? Daily kind of things that you would have to do and see to?
Well, we were working to a training program, you see. Those digging, wiring, patrolling, attacking. One of the things we had to practice was relief in the line. And most of this was at night, because that's when most things happened. And, of course, you had your normal platoon routine, a sort of morning inspection, where you made sure everyone had shaved and washed and cleaned their weapon, their own personal weapon, or any other weapon that you had in the platoon, that the place was clean, and the bunkers were reasonably tidy, and that everyone knew how much, they all had the right amount of ammunition, because I can't remember whether we actually had our first line ammunition at this stage. I don't think so. I think we just had training ammunition. And then there would be company adventures, training exercises, and these odd jaunts to the forward positions where the Gloucesters had been, really on sort of pioneer work, really.
So you're kind of taking it into the front line gradually?
We were just acclimatising and getting used to the scenery and the atmosphere of the place. Obviously, we all wanted to get on with it.
Was this the mood of the battalion, to get into it and get on with it?
Yes. Having got there, you know, let's get on with it. Because we were only doing this from, I think, a month. Well, I think towards the end of it, you know, getting a bit fed up, not doing anything in particular. So then the great day came when we were going to go into the line.
Can I just very quickly, you said that the company positions were on hilltops. Between hills, was there any kind of position or defense?
No, no. There was nothing. They were all sort of isolated hills. There were, in most of the battalion positions, obviously, tracks and paths to get from one company position to another company position. Very occasionally, they'd be linked by communication trenches. But normally you'd come off the reverse slope and move around behind the hill to get from A to B. But later on, there were a couple of positions where I in fact was with my platoon, which was a link between two battalion positions. This was a spur of a big hill, and I was plonked on there with my lot. But that is a later development. Normally it was just the company positions It may have been a series of little hills, you see, not just one hill, because it was a fairly bubbly country, and there were streams. The roads were all, there were no surface roads, they were all hard track and dirt track roads. When they were wet, they would get a bit difficult, but they had big monsoon ditches. And the main roads, the MSRs, the main supply routes, were again run by the Americans and very well looked after. And they were two-way systems, and big convoys used to thunder up and down there.